We have seen sampling and quantization. So now the image data will be in the form of an array, a two-dimensional array typically. There are ways of converting the two-dimensional array into a one-dimensional array also. So 1D, 2D, it is simply the mechanism of arranging the data. But truly, an image, in most cases, is a function of space and could be written as fxy. The space could be translated to the surface of a body or an object, or could be a planar projection of a three-dimensional body, and the space coordinates could then be just within reference to parts within the image, not necessarily of the body if you don't know the projection mechanism and parameters. In general, you would write an image as a two-dimensional function f of x, y, whereas functions of time are written as f of t for time. You could also have a function of space as f of x along one direction or dimension only. Once sampled and quantized, you may want to represent an image in the form fmn, where m and n represent the indexes or the indices of the image in some discretized coordinate system. And in that case, m and n may or may not correspond to distance in space. They could represent some other domain, not necessarily space in centimeters or millimeters, but typically images are expected to be functions of space. If you write a digital image as fmn, you could interpret that as a discretized version of fxy in a two-dimensional array or matrix. When you write something as fmn, you may interpret that as a matrix. Now, there are some notational differences that cause confusion and may also mislead one into imagining that we are dealing with just mathematical entities. So I would like to go through some aspects of representation here. There are notational differences between the representation of an image as a function of space, fxy, and as a matrix, fmn. And that simply has to deal with the coordinate axis system used. An M by N matrix, capital M, capital N being the size, is typically interpreted using standard mathematical notation of a matrix as M rows and N columns. So the first row represents the row number, so it represents the vertical axis. Whereas when you say fxy, x is like that on the horizontal axis, y is like this, or like that, going up. The height is m rows, and the width is n columns. The numbering of the elements starts with 1, 1. Now, the old-style Fortran programming did not allow the index to be 0. It had to be starting from 1. And the new style in MATLAB also does not allow you to have 0 index. It has to start with 1 because MATLAB treats everything as a matrix. So the C language and Pascal that started a few years ago, after many years of Fortran programming, the programmers in C and Pascal used to make fun of Fortran programmers as telling they couldn't handle the index of 0, but now with MATLAB, we are back with the same problem. So some, I don't know about you, you might not have such a long history of with programming languages, but people like me with history of programming in Fortran and other languages before C and C++ have encountered these issues with the index 0 being allowed or not being allowed. So in MATLAB and in matrix notation, you start with 1, 1 at the top left corner, and then you write like this or that way, the way that you would see. So with matrix notation, you have this. Let me zoom that. PDF, I can do this. I can zoom as much as I want. In matrix notation, you have F11 at the top, and going like that, first row, second row, third row, column 1, column 2, column 3, column 4. This is matrix notation, FMN, whereas the same image in the XY coordinate system using the first quadrant will go like this. This is the X-axis, this is the Y-axis, this is F00 near the origin being here, and X increases like this, so the axis is different, and Y increases like that. So with Y, not only is the axis different, it goes in the opposite direction as compared to matrix notation. So what is M is minus Y, and what is N is X. I can read finish now. I know that command. So the same data will be seen as a 3x4 matrix or a 4x3 array. When you show an image, the first dimension that you mention is this, the width, and then the height. Whereas for a matrix, it is the height, number of rows, and then the number of columns. So there is always a source of confusion. This is always a source of confusion, which dimension you give first, and whether it is horizontal or vertical. And the indexing is the opposite for the vertical axis. So you have to recognize that, whether you write your program in C or C++ or Pascal. Nobody uses Pascal nowadays, I suppose. So C, C++, and Java maybe. And MATLAB, they're different. So you have to take care of that. So a function of space FXY that has been converted into digital representation FMN is typically placed in the first quadrant in the Cartesian coordinate system. And then an M by N, or there should be a word there, an M by N array will have a width of M and height of N, which is the opposite of what we saw for the matrix. So the indexing of the elements will start with 0, 0 at the origin and will go to m-1, n-1 at the upper right corner. The size of the matrix is rows times columns. The size of the image is width times height, and these are opposite. So that is something, a source of confusion that you have to handle. So what is vertical in one representation is horizontal in the other. So there are some operators we will call as vertical derivative or gradient and horizontal derivative or gradient. And which is which will depend upon which coordinate system you use, whether you use MATLAB or C, and how you program the axes. Okay. There is a notion of optical density that is associated with images on film. And you may encounter this variable or name, so it's good to know that. The value of a picture element or pixel may be expressed in terms of several quantities. A physical attribute such as temperature, density, X-ray attenuation coefficient, and so on. That table I showed earlier. The intensity of light reflected from the body at the location corresponding to the pixel, which is, if I were to stand here and take a picture of you, it is the light reflected from every point on you. Or the transmittance at the corresponding location on a film rendition of the image, and optical density corresponds to the film-based representation, in particular as related to X-ray images, because that was the predominant mode of representation of images in medical imaging. And also in imaging of biological samples using transmission electron microscopy and several other modes of imaging would eventually put the image on film. The optical density at a spot on a film is defined in terms of its transmittivity, how much you put in and how much comes out. Now let me go to the next and show this picture. So here is a sheet of film, and you shine light through it, and how much you put is the incident light, and how much comes out on the other side is the output. And depending upon how dark that spot is, the light is attenuated. The light that you put in is attenuated. So the film is at transparency in this case. And optical density is log to base 10 of the input light intensity divided by the output. So it's a positive quantity, and if the light is attenuated by a factor of 1,000, which is a very dark spot on film, the optical density is 3. If it is perfectly clear and no light is lost in passing through the film, then the two will be equal and log of 1 is 0. So a perfectly clear spot will have optical density equal to 0 or almost 0. You may never get 0 because in film there will be some fog, some background intensity, some background shade, and there will be some loss of transmission of light through even perfectly clear film. So you may not get optical density equal to 0, but you may get 0.00 something. X-ray films have a dynamic range of optical density nearly 0, 0.001 or so, to about 3.5. And that's a very good dynamic range, which is of the order of 2 to 3 or 4,000. A dynamic range of 0 to 4,000, or a range of 4,000, is an exceptionally large dynamic range for detectors. Only recently, over the past 5 to 10 years, or perhaps the past 10 years, have digital detectors reached this dynamic range and have recently have provided even larger dynamic range. There are some digital detectors with the dynamic range of 10,000. And there are some LCDs that claim in display monitors a dynamic range of 3,000 or 10,000. So this range, until about 10 years ago, was considered to be a very large dynamic range, and many systems, physically built transducers and systems, could not match this dynamic range of operation. So the film remained the best detector for light imaging as well as X-ray imaging for nearly, for more than a century, for perhaps for photographic imaging, 2 centuries. X-ray imaging, about 1 century. So that brings us to dynamic range. What is the dynamic range? The dynamic range of an imaging system or a variable is its range or gamut of operation. And sometimes you may limit it to the linear response range. You may not care about parts where the system is not linear. It is expressed as the maximum minus the minimum, or maximum to the minimum range by specifying the limits. And X-ray films for mammography, I mentioned, give a dynamic range of 0 to 3.5 optical density. Remember that that is a log, log to base 10, giving 3.5. Modern cathode ray tube monitors, CRT monitors, provide dynamic range of the order of 0 to 600 candelas per meter square in luminance, or 1 to 1,000 in sample gray levels. Now, when I say modern, I should remove the modern. This was about 6-7 years ago. Now, with LCD monitors, it is much higher than this. I don't remember in candelas, but many manufacturers of LCD television sets claim 3,000 to 1 or even 10,000 to 1 dynamic range. I'll go back to that in a little while. So here is a picture of what is called the HD curve for 2 hypothetical imaging devices. The input is the log of exposure. It could be in the number of X-ray photons or light photons applied to the device. And this is the optical density, the amount of blackening of the film, let's say, or the output in log scale. Now, there is a certain portion here that is linear in terms of optical density versus log of exposure. So this is log log. So here you have a linear range of operation for one device, and another device operates like that. So which is better? In a response like this, we need to look at not only the linear portion that you would like to operate in or within, but also the toe range and the shoulder range. The toe is the low range where below a certain amount of exposure, the output is constant at a low level. Could be zero, but typically it is not zero. The film, when it is perfectly clear, before exposure to X-rays, is expected to be clear, but may not be absolutely transparent. There could be a little bit of some gray shade, let us say. So there is some background level that is called the base of the film, fog or noise. And it could be in the transducer too. If this transducer or detector is a solid state device, this would be the black current. Even if you shut your camera and measure the current in your CCD array, there will be some current because of thermal activity. Unless you cool it to absolute zero using liquid nitrogen, or even that doesn't take you to absolute zero, cool it to very, very low temperatures, there will be some low current in your detectors. That will be the background level. After a certain amount of input, then there is an increase in the response, and there could be a nonlinear portion here, and you don't want to operate here. So up to about this level of input is not a useful range. Then you want to operate in the linear range, and after a certain range, there is a shoulder at which point the device saturates, and beyond which the output is constant at another level. There is a range also in some devices where the output could reduce. I have not shown that. I only shown up to the saturation range. Okay, so in this case, device A has a larger slope or gamma than device B and can provide higher contrast. I need to switch back and forth, excuse me. So here, the slope of this device is sharper, a higher slope than device B. So this has a higher gamma, and it will give you better contrast. For a small range in the input, the output range is bigger in device A than device B. So this device, because of the sharp slope or high slope, will give you high contrast. But the range of linear operation is narrow. So the linear dynamic range of device A is narrow. What is called the latitude or the spread is small for device A, but contrast is high. Device B has a longer or wider range of operation where it is almost linear. But if you take a small range in the input, the corresponding output range is small, smaller than what device A will give you. So the contrast of device B is lower. So you have to again perform a trade-off. Do you want a wide dynamic range, in which case the slope will be small, so contrast is poor? If you want high contrast, you need high slope, but then the dynamic range of operation in the linear portion will be smaller. So that is the trade-off. So device B has larger latitude or breadth of exposure and optical density over which it can operate in the linear range than device A. So one does well or better in one aspect and not the other. So plots of this type, log of X-ray exposure versus film density, optical density, are known as Herter-Driffield or HD curves. And they're commonly used to represent the transfer characteristics of film used for X-ray imaging or light imaging too. So what causes the dynamic range in medical images? For example, air in the lungs and bowels will have very low density and very low attenuation. X-rays will just go through with little or no attenuation within the air, but then we have the surrounding skin and bones and fat and so on. And also fat in various organs will have low attenuation and low density, lower than water, and most tissue and also blood will have density higher than that of water. Blood is just a little denser than water. Tissue a little more, most tissue in the human body. Bone will be higher. But fat will be lower, air will be much lower. So at the low end, we have air, and then somewhere in the middle, we have water. Less than water is fat. And higher than water, just a little higher, is blood. A little higher, soft tissue. Much higher, hard tissue like bone. And much higher if there are any metallic implants. Now, in a mammogram, there could be calcifications in the breast. If you're taking an image of the chest, then there'll be bone. In a mammogram, there could be calcifications, and within the dynamic range expected of a mammogram, the breast tissue will be low density, fat will be lower, the breast will have some amount of fat, especially at the periphery, skin will be lower density, tumors will be higher density, any liquid in cysts will be low density corresponding to water, close to water, but calcifications in the breast would be of high density, close to that of bone. Not as much as bone, but fairly close. So if there is air present in the image, you have the dynamic range going downward. If there is fat, down also below that of water. If there is calcification or calcium or bone, it'll go on the higher side. So depending upon the part of the body you are imaging, you need to figure out what is the dynamic range of interest. So mammograms, again, the dynamic range is 0 to 3.5 in optical density on film. And in CT images, the dynamic range is minus 1,000 for air to plus 1,000 approximately for bone in Hounsfield units. I haven't given you the definition of Hounsfield units. It is the linear attenuation factor of the tissue divided by the attenuation factor for water and the, that times 1,000. An important measure of the difference between two regions in an image is contrast. The brightness value of the pixel is important, but for us to perceive an object, there must be a difference between that object and the immediate vicinity or the surrounding. If there is no difference, we cannot perceive the object. The human visual system operates like a bandpass filter. What we detect is the difference. So if there is no difference, we cannot detect it. We are not sensitive to the specific optical density or brightness measure or the light level. In fact, that is immaterial. A very simple illustration is I can recognize you here in this low light level. We can step outside right now and I can still recognize you because what is being sensed by my visual system, and that's true for everybody here, not just mine, by the human visual system is the difference between the optical density of the object and the background. So if you take a piece of white paper and put it on a white sheet of paper or screen, obviously you cannot see it. The same for black versus black, but white versus black is obvious. And that is the notion of contrast. What is also called simultaneous contrast. There has to be a difference between the object and the immediate background. And if F is the value of the foreground object and B is the value on the average of a surrounding background, then if these are in optical density units, which are already normalized, contrast is F minus B. And because optical density is already normalized, you can just take the difference. But if they are not normalized, you need to normalize. If F and B represent the pixel values of brightness or density or something else not normalized, then contrast is defined as F minus B divided by B, just the background, or F plus B. You need a reference. Considering this, what this measure says is you need a difference between F and B to visualize it, and how you perceive it is not simply F minus B, but F minus B divided by B. as a fraction of the background. So the brighter the background, the more the difference should be. F minus B must be larger for larger B in order for us to perceive it. Because you are comparing the foreground with the background, this is known as simultaneous contrast. And because the human visual system is a bandpass filter, it is not sensitive to the average value, DC or direct current or zero frequency, but it is sensitive to the difference. An example that is often given is this. You must have seen this in some textbooks. These two patches of gray have exactly the same value. I created this digital pattern, so I know these two values are the same, but this value of the background is different from that value. The effect of that on most of us, most of you, is that you perceive this to be darker than that. I hope all of you agree with that. All of you should be perceiving this object to be darker than that object, even though by design they are the same. And that is because the background of this object is lighter than the density or brightness of this object, whereas lighter in the sense brighter, whereas in this case the background is darker. So the difference here is positive, which makes you feel that this is brighter. The difference here is negative, which makes you feel this is darker. Quantitatively speaking, the box on the left-hand side is 130 against 150. The background is 150, whereas the object is 130. Divided by 150, the value is minus 0.1333. That is contrast, it is negative contrast. On the right side, the object is the same, 130, the background is 50, and you get plus 1.6 as the contrast. So, using one of the definitions of contrast, one gives you a positive contrast, the other gives you a negative contrast. And the amount of the contrast is different. The sign is different. So this leads to the perception of this square as different from that square, where in reality, they're exactly the same. So this is one of the illusions that is commonly used to explain the behavior of the human visual system. But the basic nature involved here is the fact that what we sense is the difference, and the human visual system behaves like a bandpass filter. Related to this is what is called the just noticeable difference. F minus B divided by B. There's a certain minimum value for this below which we cannot perceive the object. And for most of us, it is 2% or 0.02 at different levels of illumination. At most levels of illumination beyond a certain minimum level, this is constant at about 2%. And this is known as Weber's law. One example is this, where I created this test pattern. The background is constant at 150. The first bar, most of you should be able to see, almost all of you should be able to see this bar. This is at 155. And that's only 5 out of 150, which is just a little more than 2%. So this is just noticeable, according to Weber's law. And after that is 175, 195, 215, 235, and these are all obvious. So the contrast of these objects, the four objects on the right, is more than adequate for most of us to perceive. But the first one is just at the border of perception, and for the first one it is 0.033, which is 3.3%. If I had put something at 2%, some of you wouldn't have been able to recognize that. I didn't do that, I started with 3%. So this is an important issue in the analysis of the quality of images. Is the detail that you want to be seen in the image at an adequate level of contrast, at least 2%, with respect to its background in the image. And there are different factors that affect the visibility or perceptibility of an object in an image. The various imaging parameters will have an effect. X-ray exposure, the KVP, the kilovolt peak applied, the MAS, the milliampere second applied, that relates to contrast in the output image. So in a mammogram, a calcification that appears against fat of low density tissue may possess high contrast and be easily visible. Suppose there is a piece of calcium or calcified deposit, and suppose that the background in the immediate vicinity is low density fat. The projection of that will show the calcification clearly against a dark background. But a similar calcification against a background of high density breast tissue or a tumor, if a calcification is present within a tumor and the tumor volume has high density, higher than surrounding breast tissue, when that is projected onto an X-ray film by projection imaging in mammography, then that same calcification within the tumor may have low contrast and may be difficult to detect. So a given object of a specific characteristic may be visible in one situation and not visible in another situation within the same image, depending upon the background, because of the effect of simultaneous contrast. So here is a part of a mammogram where there are many bright specks that are deposits of calcium. In this part of the image, you have calcifications superimposed by a bright area, relatively high density breast tissue. In this part, you have low density, which is a fatty area. And there are calcifications here too. So the contrast of two calcifications that are of similar size and density, and I cannot say which is which here, because I don't have measures of density of calcifications, but suppose there is one calcification here, one piece, and another piece of similar characteristics. Their appearance would be different because of the surrounding objects and density. That is the notion of simultaneous contrast.